Hi, I'm Nora Cavani, and this is Healthy Gut, Healthy Kids, your trusted source on child gut health, brought to you by Alba Health, live on the UK Health Radio. Thousands of studies now link a child's gut health to common symptoms like colic, constipation, and eczema, as well as to long-term health risks like allergies, asthma, and obesity. In each episode, I speak with global experts and scientists to explore the latest research on children's nutrition, gut health, and well-being. Let's dive into the science. Welcome, Federica. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited about this conversation.
Let's get started with why you decided to study nutrition, to do your PhD there, and why focusing on early life?
Yeah, so I actually started in biomedical sciences, pharmacology, and then I went into public health first. So whilst I was studying my master's in public health and then started working in public health at the Department of Public Health at Imperial College, I was interested in chronic diseases. And I started to notice that there was a lot of research and evidence pointing to the importance of nutrition for chronic disease prevention. So in public health, the goal is really to try and work with preventative medicine. How can we stop lots of people getting sick instead of intervening when they already need hospitalization, which is like tertiary care, it's the last step. But for me, the spark went off when I realized that so many diseases that we're trying to help to bring down are so closely linked to nutrition. And it was the EPIC cohort cancer findings that really caught my eye. So I was lucky to be taught by Elia Ribbeley, who's one of the lead PIs on that, on EPIC. And he was presenting some data to us as students being like, okay, so we found that higher consumption of processed meat is correlated with, you know, an increased risk of cancer, especially colorectal cancer. I was sitting there thinking, oh my goodness, we don't talk about this enough. So that's what sparked my interest. And whilst I was doing my PhD, I did my PhD at Imperial College as well. And they didn't, at the time, they didn't offer a master's in nutrition that was specifically about nutrition science. They did one for how to run clinical trials. That's not what I wanted. I wanted like the science. So I actually ended up doing my master's in nutrition at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And that was the final degree I did. But throughout my PhD, I was publishing research on my own data set, which was an NHS data set, but I was also publishing research on nutrition. And I was especially interested in what point in the life course has the biggest impact. And very quickly, I realized that the first 1,000 days is the window of opportunity where you have the biggest chance to have impact with nutrition. The first 1,000 days refers to this time period between conception and second birthday. You get amazing long-term health benefits for the baby and for the mother. So in terms of bang for your buck, public health intervention, there is nothing quite like the first 1,000 days because you get to have long-term and immediate impact on health for multiple people. And I think what's important to note is that a lot of the research we have is looking at low-income settings. So what happens with undernutrition? What happens in these populations where mothers can't access food pre-pregnancy, during pregnancy? So we have a lot of knowledge around that, around undernutrition from these populations. And we also have, to be fair, a fair amount of understanding and knowledge for overnourished or malnourished women who have a poor diet, but an abundance of calories. But that's a newer thing, right? So it's a more recent development in the past, say, 30, 40 years. You're seeing this shift where in countries like the UK, most women, luckily, we don't need to worry about undernourishment, but we do have this growing population that have malnourishment. So they're eating too many calories, not enough nutrients. What happens then? Yeah. And that's where it's very topical, very important time for us to be focusing on this, because I think the narrative for populations where they have access to food has been, well, don't worry about it, you've got access.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's, you know, we know that undernutrition is critically bad, but we've not quite, like, we've just getting to the space where like, oh, you have enough food, but are you eating the right kind of food? That's the question we need to be asking now.
Right.
And helping women to make those choices in an informed way.
Yeah, this is actually the first year where we have more overweight people than malnourished people.
Yeah.
It's the year where really
the tipping point.
Exactly, yeah. The tipping point.
What I found fascinating about what you said, actually you said so many interesting things, but I really found fascinating where you said that there's ways to predict health for a person based on their lifestyle, on their income status and many different factors. What did you find out there?
Well, so there's something called the social determinants of health. And so it's understanding that there are various layers of exposures that influence people's health outcomes. What factors in someone's life can help us to predict their outcome? Now, there are some things we can't change. So where you're born, how affluent your family is when you're born, so how much access do they have to nutritious food, to appropriate healthcare, to green spaces, to good air quality, all of these things, you don't choose that when you're born. So we have to be really aware of that. The other thing, of course, we can't change is genetics.
Yeah.
You can't change your genes. Sometimes it's like genetics will absolutely predict something nearly 100%. Things like Huntington's disease, you know, it's very strong. But for most things, genetics is like it's your starting line, but then how it plays out can be influenced with exposures. So we have to look at things like ethnicity as well, play a massive role, massive factor. One of the papers I published was looking at how ethnicity was a predictor of outcomes for a mental health intervention here in the UK called IAPT, which is increasing access to psychological therapies. Mm. And across most ethnicities, when you adjusted for income, for socioeconomic status, the effect of the ethnicities disappeared. But there were a few ethnicities where it persisted.
Wow.
So in a few cases, belonging to that ethnic group was actually a predictive factor of, in this case, worse health outcomes. So we have to be aware of the sort of predetermined things that we inherit just from how we're born and where we're born and who our parents are, the things that we can change, and then understanding the interplay between both, embracing that and then saying, okay, what can I do with my baseline?
Yeah.
So personalizing health advice also means working with people from where they're at instead of just saying, well, this worked for me, so you should all do it and it will work for all of you. That isn't how it works.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting area of research, which is adverse childhood events, ACEs.
Yeah.
There's a list of them. And you can predict certain outcomes if you know how many ACEs people have experienced in their lives. So like there's things like divorce, having an alcoholic or drug addicted parent, abuse. So there's different ACEs. And the more ACEs you have, the stronger your likelihood of things like self-harm, later addiction. So we can predict quite a lot if we know, especially early life exposures.
Yeah.
And then the exposome as a whole. So where do you live? How do you get to work? Do you like your job? Do you get to move every day? Do you have access to healthy food? It can feel overwhelming at first, but then when you realize that you have the power to shape a lot of it,
it's pretty
cool actually. So I think a lot of the work I do is trying to help people untangle what are the things actually worth knowing and worrying about, or at least thinking about changing, and then what are the things that actually are marginal.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If we look at the first years of life, first 1,000 days, so actually from pregnancy to the first years of a child, what are the main factors that can affect health for the baby, for the mom, long term?
Yeah. Okay, so actually preconception, sort of 90 days before conception, we need to start thinking about the quality of the sperm and the quality of the egg. Now, two very different things, because in 90 days, a sperm goes from being a germ, like a germ cell, to a fully fledged sperm. So you can have a massive impact on sperm quality, motility, like sperm in general. You can really transform it in just a few months, 3 to 6 months.
Yeah.
For eggs, it's slightly different. Now, we're born with our eggs. In fact, you know, female embryos have their eggs inside the mother's womb. So we've got them before we're born.
Yeah.
And the exposures to those eggs begin from birth.
Yeah.
They're just sitting there. And so actually we accumulate exposures to our eggs from the moment we're born. But the 90 days before we ovulate, so the maturation phase, is where we can try and optimize what eggs we've got. Several eggs are sort of offered up for maturation, if you will, in the ovary. I'm thinking Italian for some reason, in the ovary. And then the ones that are then selected to mature, they will go through a process. And then usually it's one of them is picked and you'll have this lovely moment where it erupts and goes then weirdly transported down the fallopian tube, but there's no actual connection. It kind of floats across from the ovary into the fallopian tube. But in that process, that whole maturation process where the egg becomes bigger and then forms this sort of lovely follicle that's going to erupt from, you've got 90 days there where you can really maximize quality and the sort of nutrients that go into that egg. Think of those 90 days preconception as really important to act on. So ideally, if you're planning to get pregnant, then you have a good plan for 3 to 6 months pre-pregnancy. You can really optimize just the quality of the egg and the sperm, the success of the pregnancy, and essentially the health of the womb, everything, like getting ready for pregnancy, basically. So if you imagine you're preparing for this big event, most people, about 56% of pregnancies are not planned. So we have to bear that in mind. So, okay, you find out you're pregnant, you're already there. It's too late for the like optimizing preconception. But in that process, before the placenta is connected and before the embryo actually is fed through essential exchange between the mother's blood and the fetal blood, you do still get nutrients from the yolk sac. So the why the egg health is so important is because the yolk sac forms thanks to the nutritional status of the egg, if you will. And then from the actual endometrial lining, you have these endometrial glands, and they release something that's unfortunately called endometrial milk, but that contains growth factors, peptides, vitamins that actually reach the developing fetus embryo. So like what you eat in the first trimester is actually influencing your baby. I think often people think it doesn't because there isn't a placental connection yet.
What would you say to a couple who struggles with fertility? What can they control in their lifestyle that can have very big impact?
Yeah, so the main things to think about are, so your diet. So take a look at your diet. Make sure the easiest diet in the world for fertility is the Mediterranean diet. We have, I don't actually know how many studies, dozens of studies that show that a Mediterranean dietary pattern supports male fertility and female fertility, and by the way, pregnancy outcomes too. So like just crack on with that. Have a look at the pyramid. Basically it's, you know, seafood, it's nuts and seeds, it's whole grains, it's fresh fruits and vegetables, extra virgin olive oil, water is your main drink, and then occasionally have some meat. But that is basically like it in a nutshell. Lots of herbs and spices, garlic, lovely things like that. Alcohol is the other one. So there is a surprising amount. So Hertility, who are a wonderful company that do a lot of work around fertility, run a sort of report on the data from their customers. And I think they've over 1 million women. And, you know, in their report, it's surprising to see that women who are actively trying to conceive are still smoking, drinking alcohol, and using recreational drugs. And this is many, I think for alcohol, it's as many as like 15%.
Yeah.
It's quite a large proportion. And this is people who are actively trying to improve their fertility outcomes and investing in that.
Yes.
Alcohol is a no-go if you're trying to conceive. Simple as that. Reduce it. I'm not saying you can never have a drink.
Yeah.
But it can't be a regular part of your diet.
Right.
And then once you've done all those things, so if you've improved your diet, you've cut it down on alcohol, you don't smoke and you don't take recreational drugs, look at exercise. So movement is really important for yeah. health in general, but it really supports fertility as well. So whether it's, it doesn't have to be a specific type of movement, but just make it part of your daily routine.
Yeah.
Make sure that you're getting enough of that, sleep enough hours. As I said, if you're chronically underslept, that's not a real term, but if you're sleep deprived, that does change the way your body functions because it's more of a survival mode. So make sure you're getting enough sleep. And then the other thing to think about is like other exposures. So do you live in a highly polluted area? Might you consider getting like a filter for your bedroom where you will spend several hours in the night breathing the air? It might be worth doing that. Do you live in a city where the tap water might have higher levels of contamination? Listen, all tap water is safe to drink, but there are still microplastics, forever chemicals, hormone levels. I mean, London Water has, I think it still has the highest level of cocaine in it than anywhere in the world.
Wow.
Okay. So being aware of that, can you get a filter? It doesn't have to be a super expensive under the tap thing filter, but just even a counter filter for your water that you're drinking could make a difference. And then the thing that is worth remembering to do as well is like anything you're putting on your body or bathing in, there are a lot of endocrine disrupting chemicals that exist in these
yes.
products. Try and avoid like lotions and bath soaks and soaps that are very fragranced and that can have a very long list on the back. Now, there are some brands that make more sort of natural soaps and you can get, you know, Weleda, the skin food, is a classic example of a good moisturizer that does a bit of everything
yeah.
and doesn't contain phthalates or parabens or BPAs. So like have a look for products that have a better ingredient list. And then as much as possible, get to outside to green spaces. If it's a park or a forest or a field, doesn't really matter. But green spaces offer us better air quality. And they also offer us, so if you think the air that we breathe is actually very alive, you know, and we breathe like 20,000 liters a day or something outrageous. So if you can get to a space where the air biome, as I call it, it's not a technical term, but I think it gives you the idea, where the air biome is mostly from natural sources. So it's like the microbes from the soil and the leaves and the bark. And it's like, think, how often can you get yourself to a green space? Because it reduces our stress. So there's lots of lovely studies on forest bathing. It reduces our stress levels. It exposes us to like lovely, cleaner air. And it also has this effect of increasing our exposure to the air, an air biome, which is more pro-health, if you will. And so all these things, infertility, the reducing stress in green space is really important, as we said, because we do want to reduce stress levels, will help. And it sounds like a lot, right? It is quite a lot, but it's all things that are promoting for health generally. So yeah. if you can do it, it's going to benefit you in the long term. Now, again, here it's important to say there are some factors that will make fertility or getting pregnant harder that you can't necessarily change. So everything that I've just spoken about is there to help you increase your chances.
Yeah.
But being aware of our baseline chances is important. Again, so
right.
if you're some, for example, if you're a woman who's like in her late 30s or early 40s, knowing that already your chances of pregnancy are lower because of age, unfortunately, that's just how yeah. it is important to know that. So your baseline's already a bit lower. If you're somebody who perhaps smoked in their 20s, your eggs are exposed to whatever you expose them through throughout your life. So even if the unhealthy behaviors were earlier in your life, they will have impacted egg quality. So this is all to say that make those lifestyle changes for yourself to improve your health and your chances of fertility regardless.
Yeah.
But be aware that our levels, our baseline starting points different depending on our background and our genetics. If your mother entered menopause early, you're more likely to have early menopause too. So ask your mum when she entered menopause, because if your mum's menopause was early, so say in her 40s or late 30s, your fertility will start declining a lot sooner than someone whose mother entered menopause in her 50s. Yeah, it's a lot of factors, but I feel like if we get the big ones out of the way, diet, exercise, sleep, and stress, then you're going to be doing a really good job. And then we can sort of tweak the water, the air. We can tweak like which products you're putting on your skin for like a little bit more. But as I said, the big change comes from those lifestyle factors.
The station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And as you said, they help with fertility, but just in health in general.
Yeah.
And they will have even bigger effects during pregnancy, during the first years, exactly, 1,000 days of life. And what can they affect in the life of a child? What are diseases that could be affected or, you know, health outcomes?
Yeah, okay. So this is, it's a huge topic. There's some amazing research looking at, for example, maternal stress and infant outcomes. There's a big piece of research that was done at the MRC in Gambia. They followed up children who were born in the Gambia at different seasons and followed them for 60 years, which is amazing wow. follow-up. And they found that those children who were conceived when the maternal diet, so it depended on the time of year in the rainy season. So if children were conceived right after the season when there was lots of leafy greens, lots of vegetables, so like just after the rainy season, then maternal diet was basically richer in things like folate from the fresh greens, and there was more abundance of fresh foods. Those children had a lower risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and early death compared to the children who were conceived just after the dry season. Mm-hmm. So there was less access to these fresh fruits. So those kinds of studies really help us to understand how even within the same population, same setting in the Gambia, but with just different access to types of food can have a long-term impact in people in their 60s.
Wow.
Really cool. If your mother or you as a mother, again, BMI was over 30 at conception, the baby is at higher risk of type 2 diabetes is in adulthood and higher risk of obesity later in life as well. It's interesting when you look at different systems, they influence health outcomes for the baby as an adult in different ways, whether it's like stress and hypertension, or as I said, obesity in the mother has different risk factors to obesity in the father. So one of the reviews I led was looking at infant adiposity. So when babies are born, we can measure what their body composition is essentially. And we can look at maternal diet and see how that influenced the body composition and then see how that body composition changing influences long-term health outcomes. Now, in mothers, a diet that was high in animal protein and sugar-sweetened beverages as separate risk factors had a big predictive effect on the child's adiposity at birth. So women with obesity are more likely to also give birth to smaller babies sometimes, especially if they don't have a gestational diabetes. there's that something called rebound growth. So these smaller babies, if they catch up their growth really quickly, too quickly, there's like a sweet spot of catch up, then they're more likely to be obese as adults.
Wow.
One of the pieces of research that Professor Sarah Berry is involved, it's sort of one of the PIs on, and that I'm involved in, is looking at why there's such a rise in early colorectal cancer at the moment, so under the age of 50. And everything at the moment is pointing to early life exposure. A paper was published from the group looking at ultra-processed food consumption and increased risk of colorectal cancer, early colorectal cancer, and there is an increased risk. So what you're eating when you're pregnant is potentially increasing or decreasing the risk of early colorectal cancer in your baby.
Right. So the health of a child starts already with the parents, mm-hmm. before conception, mm-hmm. during conception, during pregnancy, yeah. and the first years of the child's life. And where is the microbiome in this, yeah. the gut microbiome? Yeah.
So the gut microbiome for fertility is very interesting, because we know that gut dysbiosis in the mother predicts worse fertility outcomes. So like if you have a poor gut microbiome, then you're more likely to find it tricky to yeah. get pregnant. And there's a sort of bi-directional communication pathway between the vaginal microbiome and the gut microbiome. The vaginal microbiome is imperative for fertility, because it basically either makes your womb and your vagina a welcoming place for the sperm to arrive and to, you know, do their thing, or blocks it. So vaginal microbiome and the gut microbiome talk to each other. They're very closely connected, obviously, also physically. And making sure that one of the ways you can support your vaginal microbiome is to support your gut microbiome, basically.
Yes.
Our metabolism changes during pregnancy to help us to absorb as many nutrients from food as possible and to optimize the baby's growth and protect baby from any kind of issues. So the vaginal microbiome becomes very defensive to keep pathogens out. But then in the third trimester, something magical happens. And some of the gut microbiome species start to appear in the vaginal microbiome of the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like a blueprint. So there's like the vaginal microbiome creates this really cool blueprint of the microbes that you want to see in the baby. So bifidobacteria are really important. And you see that vaginal microbiome starts to change. You can predict, you can actually look at vaginal dysbiosis in pregnancy and predict preterm labor. That's how powerful it is. And in pregnancy, the microbiome also has a role. So maternal diet is Mediterranean, high in fiber, high in polyphenols, high in bioactive compounds, high in long chain fatty acids, polyunsaturated fatty acids. These all reach the gut microbiome of the mother, and the gut microbiome of the mother uses it to create chemicals that are useful for the baby. And then after birth, so depending on birth, delivery is important. Babies who are born through the vagina have an instant exposure to the microbes that are supposed to colonize the gut, whereas cesarean birth does result in a different colonization. So you see that children who are born by cesarean delivery have essentially skin bacteria and very different profile in terms of their gut microbiome compared to babies who are born vaginally. The way that gut microbiome helps to shape health in the early, especially the early months, is immune system. Like literally training the immune system to survive is a really important part, but also making sure that the brain, so the gut-brain axis is very early on in development. There's this real bi-directional interplay between the gut microbiome and the brain. And we can help to nourish that. And this is where breastfeeding comes into play.
Yeah.
Breastfeeding is the best way to feed your baby for the first 6 months of life. And there's lots of reasons for it. It's a live liquid. It is not one thing. There are so many factors in breast milk that support human growth in exactly the way it's supposed to happen in the first months of life. But it also plays its pivot. Most of the breast milk is there acting as a probiotic to seed the right microbes. And it's not just the milk, it's also the nipples that have different microbes. And you see translocation from the gut to the breast milk in mothers. We think through the macrophages. So you actually see that maternal immune system supports baby's health by providing the right probiotics, the right strains, the right even down to the right antibodies from her own body to help protect the baby while the immune system's sort of gearing up to be useful. Because in the first few months, babies' immune systems are not mature. They can't do very much.
And which are the key bacteria that really do all of this work and are very important in the
bifidobacteria, first? By far, in the first months of life, the bifidobacteria play a huge role in this. And they, I mean, Bifidobacterium infantis is the most famous one, but there's lots of them. And they also, what's interesting about bifidobacteria is they create more of an acidic environment in the gut, which also protects against things like gastrointestinal infections, which in babies can be really dangerous.
Yeah. And one of the most worrying things I've seen in the past years is that some studies are showing that a lot of babies today don't have bifidobacteria. Mm. So 25% of babies in the US in a study do not have bifidobacteria at all. We actually see similar things in our study in Sweden, so that more and more kids don't have bifidobacteria. Actually, what we see is that even children that are vaginally born, mm-hmm. breastfed, no antibiotics, don't have bifidobacteria. And sometimes we looked into the mother's gut microbiome and she didn't have bifidobacteria. So what we're seeing today is something that is a bit challenging what we knew before. Because if the parents or if the mother doesn't have bifidobacteria, then she cannot transfer them over time.
That's right. This is the problem with, like, we're in the second generation of sort of poorer nutrition. And and I think, you know, a lot of mothers would have bottle fed in the 50s, 60s, 70s, because that was sort of recommended. Now we have that second generation where it's like, okay, we've lost bifidobacteria from, that's shocking though, 25% is bad. Breastfeeding is quite impressive because it will literally rob the mother of nutrients to provide for the milk for the baby. But if the maternal nutrition is such that there just isn't enough vitamin A, then you end up also with the micronutrients not being optimal in the breast milk.
You also talked about antibiotics. So let's talk about antibiotics and how they can affect early life and health later in life.
Yeah. So I think it's important to start by saying that the antibiotics are used to save lives, right? Because infection at birth is extremely serious and can kill a baby. So it's not about putting fear of antibiotics. It's more that antibiotics in early life disrupt this very important moment where you're really creating the scaffolding for the gut microbiome. So this is why the study that from Harvard, I can't remember the author, we looked at children under the age of two, is because you can imagine you've got this really intense scaffolding and blueprinting time. And if you take like a broad spectrum antibiotic at that time, it just wipes out a lot, if not all, of the helpful microbes that we're trying to like make their ecosystem. And so then we see this sort of reset, and children who have repeated antibiotic exposure at higher risk of allergies, obesity, and now we're looking at the other health outcomes. So whether it's like metabolic dysfunction, type 2 diabetes, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, things that basically influence metabolic function. I don't know that we have enough data to suggest whether they increase the risk of cancer. Mm. Don't think that's so clear. But certainly with metabolic health and immune system function, which then links into conditions like irritable bowel diseases, repeated antibiotic exposure in younger years does seem to play a part there. Hopefully we're moving away from, certainly when I was growing up, anything happened, you could just take an antibiotic. And same. In a country like Italy, where I grew up, you don't need a prescription. So you just go and you get it and you take it. And it's like, have you got a cold? Antibiotics. We're moving away from that, I think, as a society. And here in the UK, GPs are recommended not to overprescribe antibiotics. It's also because we are at a bit of a critical stage. If we want to avoid antimicrobial resistance from killing us all, we need to slow down with the antibiotic use.
Yeah.
So just knowing that,
right.
Take them if they're necessary, of course. But if they're not necessary, just ask the question.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think there is a case for restoring the gut after antibiotics?
Yes. Yeah, definitely there is. With what's clear, though, is that restoration after antibiotics depends a lot on the prebiotics.
Yeah.
So feeding the gut microbiome again with the right substrates that actually help the good guys to flourish, more so than like aggressive probiotics.
Yes.
Basically encouraging consumption of a variety of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, legumes, pulses, so beans, peas, all those wonderful things, and then fermented foods, yogurt, kefir, sauerkraut, kimchi. So try and get a variety of live ferments from a variety of foods, and then lots of prebiotics from your food, and then your ecosystem will repopulate with the right microbes for your niches.
Right. A lot of people are under the impression that probiotics are the only intervention you can take for the gut microbiome.
No.
And a lot of people are under the impression that if you take probiotics, you're supplying bacteria to your gut and they will stay in your gut.
It's like any other ecosystem. Okay. If you introduce a new beast to an ecosystem, unless there is a niche for that beast or that plant to thrive, it will get kicked out by the existing bugs, right? So it's the same with the gut microbiome. Everyone's gut microbiome is different. So we know this, right? And everyone's gut microbiome at any given time point, whether it, like this month or next month, has a different composition and a niche that might come up. We are not there yet with understanding when your niche is free for this microbe. Like, we're nowhere near that. We're just now seeing that actually when you supplement with probiotics, most of the time they act as they go through as they go through your GI tract. They'll transit through and they'll have some action. If they're live, if they find some prebiotics on the way down, they'll do some stuff, and then you'll poop them out. They might land on the top layer of your gut microbiome, which is the layer that every time you go to the loo it leaves, but then they'll go. This is why with probiotic supplementation, people who report improvements report them as long as they're taking it.
Yeah.
And then as soon as they stop, it goes.
Yeah. A lot of people ask me, which probiotic do you take? What do you recommend? What should I take every day? And I always say, I don't take a probiotic every day.
Exactly.
That is not recommended. And there is no evidence that that will support your health, really. They have a time and place, but they're not there to support your gut microbiome every day. Food and nutrition is what really makes the difference.
Yeah.
I'm Nora Cavani, and thank you for joining me on Healthy Gut, Healthy Kids, live on UK Health Radio. This episode was brought to you by Alba Health. We analyze your child's gut health, provide personalized nutrition plans, and coaching for the best start in life. We are the first and only company with a large clinical study on child gut health, and our team counts over 1,600 scientific publications in this topic. We translate this complex science into simple, personalized actions for families. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.